period of time in my life where in the space of a few months, I lost my father to cancer. I broke my foot. So in cast, I split it with an ex, which is quite like volatile. She took my dog. Mm. I had to move house because she was taking everything back to Germany. I had to get another place and I had to find and move house. What else happened? And then just trying to get around London on one leg. And also trying to sell my dad's house in Birmingham and like clear it all out, etc. Oh, and just before all of that started, I got attacked, got a big black eye and like cut. And that was 2 days before I broke my foot. And it was actually the same doctor in A&E. You had quite a laugh
at my
misfortune. God. But all of that. And actually, it was fine. Like, obviously, there was a sadness. But it allowed me to just stay on that middle path and actually respond to things as they are in front of me. Mm. See them for what they are and respond in kind of just a loving, calm way.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of For Soul's Sake, a podcast in which I aim to give you honest, candid, unfiltered conversation on spirituality, yoga, holistic wellness, all of that jazz, alongside a whole host of amazing guests. We've had some amazing episodes, and this is lined up to be another one. I'm really honored and deeply grateful to welcome our latest guest, Adam Huster, to the podcast. Adam is a London-based, renowned yoga teacher specializing in alignment-based vinyasa yoga after his fascination with anatomy. He brings a unique perspective to yoga by drawing from his previous experience in law school, believe it or not, the boxing ring, the ultra marathon, or the nonprofit sector, creatively teaching his students to balance flexibility and strength, physicality and mentality. Adam's unique approach to yoga has led him to rigorously deliver workshops and trainings at over 60 studios, including one of the world's leading gyms, Equinox, and in over 20 countries around the world. Adam's also the co-host alongside his wonderful wife, Holly, of the amazing podcast, Honestly Unbalanced, which hosts conversations with people that have spent their lives trying to make yours better. Adam, pleasure.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for being here.
No, absolute pleasure.
Thank you for driving all the way from Surrey to be here.
It's chilled, actually. Our little baby slept.
Oh, yeah?
Which is rare. Normally, you hate a car seat, but he managed to sleep for the whole hour and a bit.
Success.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect, yeah.
Yoga, let's get stuck in.
Go on, far away.
You are definitely an icon in the yoga world as someone who is making yoga accessible, relevant, applicable, all the buzzwords under the sun. And you're doing it on top of that as someone in a man's body.
Mm.
Has that been challenging?
In terms, challenge-wise, no. I guess in the yoga world, yes, there are more females doing yoga than men. And a lot of people start yoga because they've either had some kind of trauma in their life or they've had some kind of injury. Or at least that's how it used to be. Now a lot of people do yoga because it's cool. It's kind of it's a whole subculture around it. Mm. And so I started yoga for both of those reasons, in that I wanted my boxing to get better.
Interesting.
I wanted my recovery to get faster. And you know, I was going through a breakup and all that stuff. And I was reading a lot of actual Hellenistic philosophies rather than kind of yoga philosophy.
What do you mean by Hellenistic philosophies?
So a lot like Stoicism, Epicureanism. Cool. You know, a huge amount of overlap. With kind of, you know, Buddhism and the more yogic philosophies. But I came into it via that, and I was always often the only guy in the room. And I never really felt any kind of issue with it. Maybe at times it gave me some kind of advantage, in that when I became a yoga teacher at the time, most of the men that taught yoga were either very, very hippie.
Yep.
At the time, like, you know, the hemp things, long hair. I did have long hair, though, to be fair.
Oh.
But lots of, like, beads everywhere, et cetera, were either that or were, like, movement artists, kind of dance, et cetera, who could, like, move their body in fantastic ways. And I guess having someone, you know, from a law background who was, like, a runner and a boxer and a weightlifter with a bit of a niche. So I guess in that sense, maybe it did help me build my classes initially. In terms of the kind of the yoga body, as it were, you know, a lot of what people teach in modern yoga is actually not suited to the Western body at all, male or female.
Mm.
It's kind of suited to more kind of younger kind of Indian boys with quite slim waist, etc. Slim, long, often sort of like longer proportions in terms of their arms and legs. So actually, I think both Western females and Western males have some difficulty doing what we might describe as traditional yoga.
Mm.
And that's why I encourage it to evolve based on kind of contemporary understanding of the body and based on actually who's in front of me. And
wow.
I think yoga is for everyone, but not every style of yoga and not every pose in every incarnation is for everyone, is my view.
Yeah, I mean, you just touched on something that I wanted to get into, which is that, see, it's so important that we do definitely make things accessible and relevant. And that's part of my vibe as well. Like, sharing mantra, sharing kirtan has been beautiful because I've been able to, well, I'm trying to break down concepts which are very, very, in one sense, lofty, and then breaking them down for an ordinary person to just come in and chant and be part of that community. And I think that there's similar sort of things happen in the yoga world where, like you said, we're adapting things, we're making things more relevant and accessible for people. Do you think there's a danger then of things getting lost, the tradition?
Hugely. And I think...
And how do we kind of like then navigate that?
I think the more people that do yoga, the better. Because they're at least starting some journey of self-inquiry through their physical body. And you know, people might start their yoga journey because they're drawn in by handstands.
True.
Or by music-led classes. You know, with those kind of things, you might have a different view on this. I don't think that's cultural appropriation as long as they're still honouring what yoga is. Mm-hmm. I think it becomes appropriation when it's fused to something that really isn't yoga, like gin and yoga or yoga with goats or you know, whatever.
Yep.
But I think, you know, I call kind of the handstand-based yoga, although I teach it, it's kind of like beginner's yoga. Mm. It's an entry point. Most kind of Western people are used to doing stuff with their bodies. They've done PE classes at school. They're not used to meditating. They're definitely not used to kind of call and response chanting.
Definitely.
That's not part of the world. So actually, just a handstanding yoga class or a gentle stretching yoga class as an access point is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And what I normally find is when people have done yoga for long enough and their life changes and they go through stresses and they discover more, their yoga practice changes. And that's certainly the case for me. Mm. And when I started, it was hot yoga, I was topless, loved looking at my six-pack in the mirror as like an 18-year-old. that was a vibe.
Yeah.
Then it went on to like doing lots of crazy arm balancey stuff. And now actually my style is kind of, it's anatomically informed. That's my niche, is I want people to ask why. And I feel that the most tangible part of the universe that people have access to is their physical body. So I want to help people explore that. And often what people find is, although I'm giving lots of particular cues about alignment and micro adjustments, they actually have not everyone, but some have quite a deep practice. And the time flies.
Mm.
And they're not ruminating or fantasizing. They're really inhabiting their body. And something magical can come from that.
Yeah.
So although I call myself perhaps an alignment-focused teacher, there is an underlying spiritual component. It's just not overt. And it still takes people on a journey. I'm just not explicit about it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an art. Like, it's something that I know that Russell Brand, even he's a bit more overt.
Yeah.
But he won't tell the intimate parts of what he's really trying to guide people towards. And even for myself, like, I'm not explicit that I'm you know, trying to take people on a journey towards X, Y, Z, but rather just trying to invite people to experiences, to discovery. You mentioned the S word, spirituality, and so I wanted to see where that kind of falls for you. And what is that word? What does that mean for you?
Yeah, I have no... So if you ask me what the definition of spirituality is for me, I have no particular answer to that. I guess my main view of what it could be is that it's something beyond ourselves.
Mm.
Okay. And what I really believe is that we are all like water molecules in an ocean.
Okay.
And for a split second, we become a wave. Okay. Maybe not a water molecule, but you know, it's a body of water.
Okay.
And if we're in the ocean, for a split second, we become a wave. And that's our life. And as that wave rises from the ocean, it feels it's separate from the ocean. And at the end of our life, we go back into the ocean. So that is my view of spirituality, an increased realization that we are all part of the same thing.
Mm.
And where Adam ends and someone else begins, where is that? And I don't think there is a thing. I think we're just temporary waves on an ocean with some ego separation.
Wow, I like that. The ego and separation of the wave. I like that. Is that thing that we're joining onto the G word, God?
So I don't explicitly believe in kind of an omnipotent, all-powerful God. If he is omnipotent, I don't think he's a very nice person.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but I don't believe in a God per se.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we die, my belief is that we all go, it's the same thing. We are a selection of molecules right now that go back. And anything that made for me, my view, anything that made me, you know, the neurons, etc., falls back again.
Wow.
And I almost think it's a little bit arrogant to think that I exist beyond. I think we are just a brief manifestation that then goes back again into something else. I think we are all one.
Why the arrogance? I'm curious.
I just is arrogance the right word? I guess just this idea that Adam will exist forever in some form. Uh-huh. Adam will watch upon you in the future, my child. I'll always be there.
Right, I get you.
I exist.
You in this form.
I think the universe didn't exist. No. I didn't exist, and my thoughts and patterns didn't exist before my body existed.
Uh-huh.
As in, everything I've experienced in my life is changing neurons in my brain to make me, me.
Wow.
And that, just as it wasn't there before, I don't believe that will be there afterwards. But I believe we are all one, so that's all okay.
Interesting.
And I guess that's my belief. And so I don't believe in an explicit God. I just believe in an interconnectedness of all things.
Mm. Is this a philosophy that you've kind of read somewhere, or is it a life experience that's come, or where did that kind of...
I think it's all the reading I've done in the past. I'm quite an avid reader, both, you know, fiction, non-fiction, neurology, neuroscience, philosophy.
Mm.
So I read quite a lot, but then also life experience. You know, so when my father passed away, you know, I had to think, you know, do I believe in an afterlife? Do I believe he's still there in any sense? And I don't. I guess, you know, that kind of thing makes you inquire a little bit more.
Of course, yeah.
And no, I don't. Yeah. I don't believe he's there in any sense. I believe he lived. And to quote The Streets, and I think he's in Dry Your Eyes, Mate. It's one of his other emotional songs. He says, "I forgot, Dad, you left me behind to remind me of you."
Wow.
And I really like that. The fact that I think my dad's legacy is that he's left me behind. And all the things that he did, all the energy he sent to me through action, inaction, voice, etc., that energy was passed to me, and some of that still resides in me.
Mm.
And I think that's a really lovely thing, the fact that I probably watched my dad repair something. I observed the energy that took. The light energy came into my eyes. Neurons were created in my brain. And those neurons and those connections, those synapses are still there.
Mm.
And that's my belief.
Is that a similar sort of legacy you want to see? I just met your son.
Yeah.
He's beautiful. And something that I'm always curious about is leaving a legacy for the next generation, for our children, for our progeny. And at the same time, keeping them open to their own beliefs. Because I know you and your wife, and in one sense, your beliefs are kind of a bit chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
I can tell you, you're synchronized on the main stuff, but there's also room for being individuals. And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
How do you then try to create space for your son, your child, for, you know, maybe there's a spiritualist who's listening to this podcast who's also thinking something similar. How do you create space for allowing your children to then also develop their own sense of spirituality and, you know?
I guess I said this to you just before we started recording, the idea, all of my beliefs are really loosely held.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
you said it in a paraphrase.
Well, it was the idea that I have strong beliefs, loosely held. And actually, sometimes my beliefs aren't that strong. And I, over time, I increasingly try not to have too strong beliefs,
right?
Because I realize I'm massively manipulated by the media, and a lot of topics out there that people have strong opinions on, I don't know a lot about, like the train strikes. People are either one side or the other.
Right.
And I've made a real effort to chat to my friends on both sides to understand their points, and both make really valid arguments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I can never know enough to have a strong view on it beyond just how it affects me. So I really try to not be part of any kind of tribe, as it were. And I think Holly's the same. We acknowledge our ignorance, which is super. We acknowledge our ignorance, which isn't a bad thing, but really we don't know everything.
Mm.
And so let's be open to everything we can. That takes a lot of work.
Takes a lot of work.
It does. And actually I'm reading a book by Jonathan Haidt, Haidt, at the moment, called Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics.
Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics.
And you know, I'm only halfway through, but the first half is all about the different sources of morality.
Mm.
And how it can be so different culturally.
Mm.
And you know, confirmation bias and the like. It's a really interesting book, but really one thing it echoes is how hard it is to not be just drawn into a tribe. Fully. And how hard it is to actually be willing to listen to both sides of the argument. So I think in terms of bringing up our son, I will not insert any dogma into his life.
Wow.
I will want him to explore, but I would love to be able to present him with different points of view, not saying either are good or bad, but wow, expose him to as much as possible and let him have his own. But I want him, like I want my yoga students, to always ask why. Like, never take anything on face value.
Yeah, and this is interesting because I think this is where our generation differs from our parents' generation, where I felt, maybe you've had a different experience, and so I don't want to, maybe I shouldn't stereotype it, so I'm apologies for that. But
maybe
I think
we're not the same age. Maybe I'm generations below you.
Who knows?
No.
Who knows?
I think we're pretty much the same age.
I think that the previous generation, like my parents' generation, they were very much of the narrative that this is the way it is, and you should understand it because that's the way it is. And I think that our generation has this beautiful, unique ability to be able to say, I don't know. And also do that in a way which is beautiful as well. Like, it doesn't have to be, I don't know, and you know, it's I'm shutting off the door to you exploring because it's my way or the highway, you know, with our children. But rather we say, I don't know, you should explore it, you should check it out.
Yes, and I think yes and no. I think playing devil's advocate there, the generation before ours, there was a lovely social cohesion. Because everyone believed in the same thing.
Right.
And everyone is part of being part of a society, believed in the same thing, whereas the West is more about the individual. And so, like, living in the West, we become more, what do we believe? Not what do we as a group believe and how can we serve each other? It is, what do I believe and how can that serve me? And there is something wonderful about that, something scary as well, this inquiry, thinking that I'm alone and I can just make up my own view, because you don't become part of something. And maybe that is what has broken up society, because people look for...
A lack of community, you mean?
Yeah, or lack of kind of social cohesion. People look for that elsewhere, whether that be kind of in gangs, in club culture. So sometimes it could be in the gym, which is fine.
Yeah, gym culture.
But people look for it elsewhere, or actually, I think negatively, in this political polarization, we say. People want to be part of...
This side of the story, that side of the narrative.
And that's become far worse.
Yeah.
People want to be part of a group with shared views. And there's a view that humans' ability to reason wasn't about us understanding things, but it evolved to persuade others. That the evolution of reason wasn't to make us understand. It was to make others
buy in.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're scared.
This is getting deep up in here. This is getting mad deep. Kaylee, our engineer, audio engineer, is nodding furiously. It's getting deep. Let's bring it to another point, I guess, shifting gears here. Social media, you've definitely built a platform whereby many people are getting attracted to what you do. Many people are, you're a voice. You're a voice in the yoga scene, a male voice in the yoga scene. You know, we can put many labels on it. I want to talk to you about how you deal with the naysayers, how you deal with people who maybe put a cheeky little comment that's a little bit rude on there. Because I've seen, like, some of the stuff that you do is kind of very authentic and very, I saw this one reel where you're like doing funny poses where it's like how people think it should be done and how it is actually done. And I find that hilarious. But how do you deal with haters? Let's call it that.
Yeah. So I guess approach has changed over the years.
Okay.
And I you know, in the past, I've got loads of hate. I remember when I first started social media, it's like, oh, this, you can't take photos of yourself doing yoga. That's not yoga.
Is it?
That was 7-8 years ago. And that was the feedback I got. You know, any kind of yoga on social media was bad.
Wow.
And of course, all those people are now using social media and putting them photos on it. Yeah. So I've had lots of bits and pieces. My general approach, if someone says something on my social media now that is a bit angsty, if it's unnecessarily aggressive, I just delete and block them. Like, I don't need a dialogue with you. This is not a democracy. This is my feed. It's a complete dictatorship. If it's just hate and, you know, they've got an account, there's one follower and it's not their name,
yeah,
I would just delete. If it's someone that has a genuine point, still, I'll say, like your point, if we want to chat about it, come to class, come smash to a training. Because I don't want to... I think any kind of dialogue on social media like that is wasted.
Keyboard warrior.
Because you can't have a nuanced conversation. Like, you know, I'm putting out there 15-second reels. Of course, everything I say depends on the context.
Of course.
Doing a pose in the way I'm saying, completely don't do that if actually you've collapse your shoulder in the past, etc., etc. So, you know, it's social media is not a place for nuance. So I'd rather have that in person. There'll always be people that are haters and don't like the fact that you are succeeding. And of course, it's much easier to blame, say, someone else is doing something bad, rather than saying, well, I'm not doing enough.
Mm.
You know, a lot of some of the hate I've had, you know, oh, why is he going to go with those opportunities? Like, actually, for years, I've been teaching over a hell of a long time now. I was teaching 26 classes a week.
Holy crap.
And then flying out on a
flight. That's like three a day, mate.
Sometimes like five, six a day.
Holy.
And then I would fly out on a Friday night to a different country, teach four workshops, get back at 11:59 on Sunday night, then leave the house again at 6 o'clock. And that was my life for like many years.
Mm.
So I was working my ass off really hard, plus all the social media stuff. The podcast takes a lot of money and time.
Like, all, yep.
I'm spending a lot of money, resource and time to constantly build, to help draw students in. And I think, you know, a lot of the hate I have, I haven't got that much hate, to be fair, but some of the hate I've got, or things I hear kind of in the background, oh, I think it just is people who aren't willing to put the work in themselves, wanting to say they're not successful because I'm doing bad stuff.
Right.
Rather than one day, you know, he's just working harder.
Yeah.
And of course, there's, you know, maybe there are certain advantages I've had.
Mm.
Maybe the fact that I have this, you know, law background, quite confident, is an advantage. Maybe the fact, yeah, white male is a bit of a niche thing initially when I started teaching. So, you know, some people, male or women, would prefer to be taught by a male. And if there aren't that many males teaching, then fine. So there are, you know, some advantages, and maybe, well, undoubtedly, when I started teaching, especially in the hot studio, the fact that I was super athletic, teaching lots of 20, you know, I was like 20 something, teaching lots of 20 something year olds, there was probably something in that. But I've worked hard, and my view now is I try and be as much of myself as possible. Like, I don't like any kind of concept of guru. And anything,
ooh, interesting.
Anything I say is not absolute. Like, I call myself an alignment teacher, but I don't believe they're the correct alignment.
Mm.
It depends on the person's unique body. So I try and be fairly fair and measured, and I try not to put myself on a pedestal.
Mm.
Like, you know,
but you will be put on a pedestal.
But through a lot of my content, I actually try and bring myself down.
Wow.
By being silly or sarcastic,
right.
And it's that balance of being silly but also informative.
Right.
And then also making sure I'm balanced, so not putting people in risk. So I don't do any of the silly dramatic poses particularly anymore. I don't assist people in class for many reasons. I try and offer a fairly grounded view of yoga that is accessible.
Yeah.
And trying to diminish ego in any concept of superiority.
Mm.
That's really important.
It's a challenge though. It's not something that, you know, balance is, it's like walking a tightrope. You're either sometimes a little bit more lefty, a little bit more right, but finding, you know, I heard this analogy that 80% of the time a plane flying to a destination is 80% of the time not on course. It's either slightly this way or slightly that way. Only 20% of the time is it finding that niche of, yeah, okay, I'm in a balanced place here.
Of course. And it's a lifetime work. And that's why I think it's important to let go of any kind of ego.
Mm.
None of us are that grounded. No, none of us have our, can I swear on it? Like, none of us have our shit together.
Yeah.
At all. And I think it's dangerous when people try and say they have. And then people look at them. So I really, like, if any student said to me, oh, Adam, please advise me in my life.
Mm.
Like, no.
Yeah.
Like, read some books by people, do some work.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not giving you any kind of life advice because I don't know that much.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Yeah, that's interesting. In one sense, I do agree that the age of the guru is dead.
Yeah.
In the sense that I think people aren't looking for an icon who they can just kind of look up to and say, this is perfection.
Yeah.
I think that is, people are realizing through the availability of information on the internet, through social media, that actually that every single human being is fallible.
Indeed.
And I think that's amazing. Having said that, I think that there is still space for accepting a teacher. And
God,
guru
yeah.
does, you know, I think the word guru is like, you know, we can.
What is it? A bringer of light.
Yeah, the bringer of lessons, the bringer of teachings. That essence has to remain, and it's something that I speak about quite a lot. In that principle and detail, that the principle is that you need to accept some sort of lineage or some sort of teaching, so that you have some sort of grounding, and not that you're making up as you go along.
God, I think. Yeah, I think. I think we need experts.
Yeah, experts.
Whatever you want to call it. Like, for me, it's an expert. Yeah. I think you need, if someone has knowledge, you need to defer to their expertise.
Right.
And that comes back to why I don't have massively strong views on loads of stuff. I acknowledge that I am not an expert on any of these things. And I think with social media, you know, the voice of an influencer, like let's say climate change, the voice of an influencer can be as loud as the voice of someone who has studied climate change for 50 years.
Right.
And then it's all distorted. So if you've got all scientists and in a room, probably like 1% of them would be climate change deniers. The other 99%, right, right, but actually when it's presented on the media, it's one against one.
Right.
I it all gets so confusing. So my view really is I do not want to put myself on a pedestal at all. I want to just defer to experts where possible.
Right.
But I want my students also to acknowledge that to some degree I'm an expert on the style of yoga I teach.
Yeah.
So when you're in my classroom, listen to me.
Right.
But don't listen to me because I tell you what to do. Listen to me because I suggest what to do, but I tell you why to do it. And that's why I don't like to call myself a yoga instructor. I'm a yoga teacher.
Mm.
And that's why when I teach classes, every class I teach is almost like a mini workshop. Because I want there to be an education, whether that be an education about philosophy, whether that be an education about external rotation of the upper arm. I want there to be an education. I want to empower my students with knowledge, not just listen to me because I say do this or do that.
Yeah. Has there ever been a moment of challenge where you found it too much? Because being a teacher is a really interesting thing. I found that trying to teach mantra and trying to teach kirtan, you know, every week on a Friday night, it's fun, but at the same time, it's there is always going to be one or two questions that flummox me, and I'm okay with that. But have there been moments where you've been flummoxed and, you know, someone's asked you a question and you feel,
I don't know.
Don't know, yeah.
That's
my philosophy as
Or it's above my pay grade.
Yeah.
Like if someone asks something about some very particular ligament and how it's affected by a very particular disease, I'm like, that's not... ask a doctor. A doctor who's done 7 years of training. And again, that's what I think all yoga teachers acknowledge. If you've done a 200-hour training, there is a chance you've just been in Goa for 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's fine. You can still teach yoga, but acknowledge that that's the limit of your learning. And when it comes to, let's say, assisting, on those 200 hours, you probably did 5 hours on how to assist. Whereas a physio has probably done 2,000 hours of very specific, informed assisting stuff.
Right.
And on that topic of assisting, a physio wouldn't walk into a room and just start pulling people around. Whereas sometimes a yoga teacher with 5 hours of training in how to do it will do that.
Mm.
And so that's my view, is it's fine to not have all of the knowledge, but acknowledge yourself that you don't have all the knowledge, and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Love it. Should we do another combo shift?
Yeah, go on.
Money.
Yeah.
Can we talk money?
I want it.
Okay.
No.
I want it now. talking money, yoga is big business. Kirtan is big business, and it's something that I'm having to... It's a conversation that I feel like I'm having quite a lot with people on this podcast, because I think it's something that we have to acknowledge different perspectives on. I want to hear your perspective. Money and yoga and making a living from a practice which is steeped in traditional, kind of more spiritual backgrounds.
Well, you know, I think when we talk about like old school yoga,
yep.
Firstly, women aren't allowed. It's only for the yogis. You know, it's only for the people that are willing to devote their life to it.
Right.
We're in a whole different world now.
Right.
You know, we're wanting lots of people to do yoga, people who are homeowners to do yoga. We want the power of yoga to affect as many people as possible.
Mm.
It isn't just for the niche. So yes, we're not, you know, I have to charge because I'm not living in an ashram going out with an alm bowl every day for food. You know, I'm a householder, I own a house. So I think people need to charge for yoga, because there are costs involved with teaching yoga, and there are costs of studios. There's so many costs involved. So I don't think it's wrong to make money from it at all, because, you know, like I've done thousands of hours of trainings. I've taught 10,000 plus hours of yoga. I spend money on stuff to constantly advance my knowledge. I make lots of sacrifices. It's nice for me to live somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nice for me to actually have some meals. So I don't think anything wrong with charging at all. I think yoga can be very hard to make a living. And I get a bit frustrated sometimes when yoga teacher trainees tell people, no, come and do yoga, come and change your career direction and become a yoga teacher. It's a bit of a con, because actually very few people can make a full-time living out of it, and actually very few people enjoy teaching yoga.
Right.
It's an entirely different thing doing it and enjoying that and teaching it. It's really, and actually increasingly a smaller amount of people are making the money, especially with the online stuff now.
Only those with a name pre-existing.
Yeah, so like Jason Crandall, my teacher, love him, but now he's been able to just move everything online. He invested very early in equipment at that start of COVID, and you know, he's already got the content in terms of what to teach. So he just started to put his trainings online. And so lots of people will just do those trainings now. And so, and he doesn't need to share that money with studios. This is if it's just online, of course. And so many teachers are doing that. And so many people then aren't doing local trainings because there are online platforms, there are online trainings, etc. So, and a lot of people haven't come back to studios. Studios are still quieter. I think there's a slight difference. I think studios in communities, mm-hmm. in small communities where people work from home, maybe still doing okay. But the ones in big cities, I think, are struggling a little bit more for many reasons. The fact that people are doing stuff online, or sometimes when you're in the yoga wellness world, you think yoga is a big part of everyone's life.
Yeah.
And it isn't.
It's not.
Like, a lot of people, you know, do two classes a week. It's nice. It's a nice addition to their life. It lapsed in COVID and they just haven't got back into it. Right. It's fine. So I think a lot of yoga teachers actually are really struggling at the moment because they're not making that much money from public classes. And to be honest, a yoga teacher teaching public classes is the worst way to make money as a yoga teacher. Because you're sharing money and all, you know, all the costs involved.
Yeah.
You do it because, and I still do it because I enjoy it.
You enjoy it.
I think for me, not teaching publicly would really, number one, make me a worse teacher. And would degrade my love of yoga. Mm. I think it's so important that all teachers continue to teach some public classes.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
But it isn't, and it never has been, the best way to make money. Mm. Like, if you want to make a really good living from teaching just public classes, you probably need to teach 26 a week.
Damn.
Which is rare to make good money. You know, teachers make
sustainable,
money.
Sustainable, is it?
No.
Yeah.
No, especially if you have children and stuff. Mm. I think, you know, the other ways for yoga teachers to make money is privates, events, corporates, workshops.
Yeah.
But again, it's not that.
Yeah, I don't know. See, I don't know the yoga world that well to know if anyone's become a multi-millionaire through teaching yoga. Maybe through platforms.
Yeah, that's the only way they've done it. Either through teaching hugely successful trainings or through contracts with online stuff. Like Dylan Werner's.
But does that make you feel uncomfortable that people are making that much money from yoga?
I think you could argue it's a little bit selfish.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they could, the knowledge that other people that aren't making the money from it. But you could argue, actually, if someone's doing very good work, that should be shared. And it's not their fault that many people want to do the training.
Right.
So it doesn't make me feel massively uncomfortable. But you know, my view is, if you lead a kind of a yogic life, or yoga's had a profound effect on you, you don't really need that much money. Like, you know that. Yeah, the Stoics call it hedonic adaptation. And what do you need? Okay, I really want a big car. Then you buy that Land Rover Defender. Oh, you buy that Lamborghini. And you're like, oh, that's really nice. Then a week later, you're like, okay, that's okay. Yeah. Now I want something else.
Yeah.
And I think the power of yoga, or kind of those Hellenistic philosophies, and all powerful activities to actually appreciate what you have more and reduce the things you want.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, you know, we've got a nice home. It's not the biggest home in the world. It's a cottage in Surrey. There's not a lot more I want. I want to make sure our son can have a good life, like do activities. We can go on some holidays, travel a little bit with yoga. But we don't want loads. We don't want big, extravagant stuff. Yeah. We want to actually appreciate what we have. So my view there is, if someone is so financially driven as a yoga teacher, they've missed something along the way.
Mm.
If they're that financially driven. And of course, everyone has their background. Like, it could be that if you've been brought up with very little, it might have been instilled in you to just work and work and work and make money. And that is what you need for support. Not because you want the wealthy things, but you need to support your family.
Yep.
I've got a friend actually in the law world who hates it, but he does it because he feels this kind of obligation to leave more to the next generation than he got.
Yeah.
And he only hates his job.
Yeah.
So, again, there's nuance to the conversation.
Yeah, totally, totally.
But my view is that through a long-term yoga practice, I want less.
Yeah.
I want less, and I appreciate what I have more.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful for people to hear. I think it's really powerful that listeners, that even people who are, you know, maybe you've attended Adam's class, maybe you are an attendee, maybe you're a student of Adam's, and Just for you to hear that, I think that's quite profound. Mm.
But don't get me wrong, like, I think money is important.
Yeah.
To the degree it brings you the freedom to do the things you want to do.
Right. Like, what real wealth is freedom, actually.
Yeah. What people do I want to do more in my life? Go on walks with Holly in beautiful countryside.
Yeah.
That's free. But I need money to give me the freedom to do that and not be in work. So yes, as a yoga teacher, I do want to be more efficient in the long term with how I make money.
Mm.
And I do want to increase what I earn so that I have more freedom to do the things I want.
Mm.
But on that note of freedom, and I think it's important for people to acknowledge, people often get caught up in achievements.
Yeah,
I want to achieve a massive podcast. Oh, I want to, yes. I want to achieve global recognition to do this. I want to achieve a 7-figure income.
Yep.
And there's a story. It's an American, like, this idea that there was an American businessman who went on a camping trip on a beautiful lake, and he saw this guy with a little shack that rented a little bit of fishing equipment, and just fishing. And he said, oh my God, the businessman said, you've got this most amazing space. If you just build out this shack a little bit, we get some boats chartered, you employ some more staff, then, you know, in 20 years' time, you could retire and you could do all, you know, what you want to do. And the fisherman said, well, why would I do that? What I want to do is fish all day.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that right now. And so I think that happens to a lot of people. They want success and achievement, et cetera, for retirement that might not come. If they drink lots of coffee and lots of alcohol and do cocaine in between, that retirement might have come. They do all this stuff for the retirement. And what they want to do in the retirement is, well, actually, they could be doing a lot of it now.
Yeah.
Like most people, retired people I know want long walks with their grandchildren,
yeah.
Time with their family.
Yeah, spend health to get wealth, only to spend wealth to get back your health.
Mm, yeah. So that's kind of my view on making money. We need money for freedom.
Yeah.
And it's nothing wrong with a yoga teacher making money for everything they've invested, etc. But I think if you are 100% financially driven and doing things without authenticity, just to make more money and more money, I question that a little bit. Actually, in a lot of my trainings, I could charge so much more and drag it out. Like my 50-hour training, I often tell a joke, or my eight-hour sequencing training, I could easily make it 50 hours.
Easy.
And charge 10, like five times the amount. But I prefer to just be efficient and like get as many people as possible, give them that education, etc.
They'll value that in the long term.
Maybe.
Mm.
But either way, like I'm happy doing things as I am.
Yeah, there's an esoteric concept, which is, while you're speaking, it's just coming to my mind. It's that if money is otherwise known as in the Vedic culture as Lakshmi, and Lakshmi is a divine goddess, and her consort is Narayan, the masculine. So Lakshmi and Narayan are always together, just like any two lovers, always seen as, you know, even if they're separate, they're always, it's Adam and Holly, and Holly and Adam. They're somehow always symbiotically together, even if not physically in proximity. But that's how they feel most nourished when they're together. So in the same way, Lakshmi has to be used in a service of Narayan. It's understood in Vedic concept. And so in the same way, if one gets wealth, one receives Lakshmi, quote unquote, then one should use that in the service of Narayan, use that in a higher purpose, essentially. So that way, the money that's accumulated from those deeds that one has performed, they're naturally purified, because it's like you said, you get the money and you use it on material stuff, that's still more Lakshmi. Mm. It's not going to be very satisfying. And so the idea, the concept, and again, we can talk about this, the concept is that to use that money for higher purpose is way more fulfilling. So for example, for the betterment of your family, for the higher purposes of life rather than just more material accumulation,
it
won't actually satisfy you. And that's, it's an interesting concept. Any thoughts? Is it too
No, scary? No, no.
Did I blow people's brains out, or was it too boring?
No, I love that. Love that. Yeah, no, I and that's how we choose to spend our money.
Yeah.
It's either mainly stuff that brings us value, which involves us spending time together.
Right.
So I think, what do you do in a car? A car is meant to get from A to B. So for me, as long as a car gets from A to B, more importantly, keeps us safe.
Safe, yeah.
So that's what I do, want a modern car to keep us safe, and all the, you know, we have a Tiguan because it's one of the safest. So as long as, that's cool. As long as we've got, but I think to get more and more luxury, because there's no need, it doesn't serve any value to our family.
There's no value.
You know, to the family, I don't think. And, but buying, let's say buying a bike. If buying a bike means then you go on cycle trips with your family that you couldn't have before, that's spending quality time together, in a sense, in the service of others.
Yeah.
Like, so I think that's where we would choose to spend money.
Yeah, and you actually grow through
time, on time. Yeah. And just, I think, on stuff that actually serves value to some people beyond ourselves, even animals. Like, I've just spent an obscene amount of money that I probably shouldn't have spent on redoing our pond. So we moved into a cottage.
Oh, wow.
It had a pond that was kind of fully overgrown. And I thought, what do I do with this? We need to keep it safe for Sunny.
Yeah.
It's leaking.
Yeah.
What do? Do we just concrete it in? I thought, no, the newts. So the newts have cost me about $5,000. The newts. So we've had it done in a way that looks kind of nice. Lots of logs, very natural. Money we didn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
but I'm like, actually, it's like a further purpose.
Yeah.
Because this pond, when Sonny's old, we're going to get fenced. But when Sonny's older, how lovely for him to be able to explore a pond and explore the animals. The newts love it. We have such joy in seeing birds washing it and the foxes come and go. And we love that.
There's a joy in that service. You know, they will never come to you. The fox and the newts won't walk into your house and say, thank you, kind sir. But it's you know that it's making a nice difference. And even if it's just a small difference, it's a domino effect, you know.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize the effects you have on other people and take responsibility for that. And sometimes this is trying to make myself look like I'm better than thou. But sometimes it gets in the way. Like I was teaching in Austria, staying at someone's house, and they're like, please don't turn the heating on, because it's quite expensive at the moment, and you'll get the heat from there. Wow. I was like, fine. He said, but if you need it in the morning, quickly. And I turned it on quickly in the morning, then left. And I walked like 40 minutes. And I was like, oh, I left it on.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, right? Just my conscience couldn't let me just carry on with the day. I had to literally run back. And I would love to instill that in Sonny, just a sense of responsibility.
Yeah, it's a time on the map.
Other human beings in the world, I think. Yeah, I would love to instill that.
I sincerely believe that even if you're a yoga lover and you have no idea about the philosophy, the practice itself will start teaching you to be more conscious.
Completely. And just more, like I say, the long-term effect of a yoga practice for me hasn't been increasing flexibility. If anything, in the last 4 years, I've got tighter again. Yes, I've got over time, a little bit stronger, a little bit more flexible.
Mm.
But what I've noticed, it's allowed me to stay more on the middle path.
Wow.
So when things happen, whether it be, you know, I had a period of time in my life where in the space of a few months, I lost my father to cancer. I broke my foot. So in cast, I split it with an ex, which is quite like volatile. She took my dog. Mm. I had to move house because she was taking everything back to Germany. I had to get another place and I had to find and move house. What else happened? And then just trying to get around London on one leg. And also trying to sell my dad's house in Birmingham and like clear it all out, etc. Oh, and just before all of that started, I got attacked, got a big black eye and like cut. And that was 2 days before I broke my foot, and it was actually the same doctor in A&E who had quite a laugh
at my
misfortune.
God.
But all of that, and actually, it was fine. Like, obviously, there was a sadness, but it allowed me to just stay on that middle path and actually respond to things as they are in front of me, see them for what they are, and respond in kind of just a loving, calm way. And for me, that's happened on the sad stuff, but on the big stuff as well. You know, when I've been flown to a spa hotel, a 5-star spa hotel, to teach at opening conference. Oh, it's cool. It's nice. Yeah. I haven't been like, look at me, I'm the best. He's been like, okay, this is cool. This is nice. This will stop at some point. Things will come and go. Everything's changed.
Okay.
And that's good. And so I think that's what yoga's given me. The ability to just increasingly, not all the time, but increasingly see things in front of me as they are and respond in a loving, present, considered way.
Beautiful.
And I think sometimes that's a little bit missing in the yoga world. Like, people often don't reflect on what yoga gives them. They reflect on the poses or the asana or the community or this like spiritual bypassing or just an external spirituality. And actually a lot of the people I know that are, I would consider the most spiritual or who've done the most work on themselves, you wouldn't tell to look at them. They're just normal people interacting with the world. They might swear and drink beer and maybe eat meat, but they are grounded and they respond kindly to the world. And I can just aspire to be like that in the long term. And certainly I have lots of ups and downs, but they are decreasing in their frequency.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, it's like living a yogic lifestyle can start with being a meditator. It can start with being a kirtan lover. It can start on the yoga mat. And I think that we sometimes have categorized it's either this or this that will bring you higher consciousness. And I'm a big believer in it's this and this. It doesn't have to be exclusively mutually exclusive. Like, it's either this way or this way, otherwise you're not getting the full whammy. And I think that you know, higher consciousness can come from reading, from nature walks. Mm. You know, that could be your sadhana. Your practice could be going on nature walks, going and just spending time with animals. I don't know, the newts maybe. Do that.
They are lovely.
They are lovely. Newts bless you.
The one thing I would say is just a caveat to that.
Please.
I think it is important to have a formal practice.
I agree.
Whatever that is.
That was going to
so
be
I think, a lot, sorry, I think a lot of people do say, like, you know, this is my yoga. Yeah. Or I'm going on a walk today, that's my yoga. Or yeah. I'm cleaning the car, that's my yoga. It's not your yoga.
Yeah.
That yes, you might have absorbed qualities from yoga.
Yeah.
That then you exhibit while you're on that walk, such as the present state of mind.
Mm.
But it's important to have a formal practice.
I agree.
Whatever that could be.
I agree. It's very grounding. Yeah, newts bless you. Let's go into some quick fire questions. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing you love about yourself.
One thing I love about myself. Grit. I've got a lot of grit.
I can see that. One thing that you want to improve on.
At the moment, my physical body. I've let that lapse over, you know, I used to constantly like run ultras and run marathons and all that stuff and do stuff that I felt not made me unique because I wanted to be unique, but it felt like I was transcending the human condition of mediocrity.
Wow.
By doing some of these challenges, and I've missed that. And so this year, long story short, I broke my foot years ago. I've had a go ahead from a physio. I thought I couldn't run again, but this is like a really good physio. He said, you can, if you do the exercises, there's no reason why you shouldn't, as long as you make sure you're strong. So what I'd like to do in the next few years is see like some ultra marathons again. I found an ultra marathon obstacle course, which might be a bit much, physical obstacle course. I'm considering an Ironman next year. And I don't particularly run. And I don't swim or cycle particularly. I can do both of those things.
But not in a...
And it's going to see if I can fit that in whilst being a present parent. But I need that. So that's what I want to improve. Just my connection with the physical body in the sense of challenge. And I think challenges are so important. That's where you learn. And that's what I want to actually instill in yoga. I want people to find like subjective challenge. Because if you're just doing a yoga class and making nice shapes or just chilling out in poses, that's lovely.
Yeah.
That's like a nice holiday. But I want at least sometimes yoga to be like going to school, or like yoga to be like doing something hard. That's where you learn so much. The most transformative experience of my life, or two of them, was walking 800 kilometers across Spain alone. And then another one was a 100 kilometer ultramarathon race. They're like microcosms of life, and you can explore so much in them.
Mm.
They're the things that have changed me the most.
Wow. Beautiful. One thing that you wish your future son to hear. Imagine 10 years from now, Sonny, 11 years old.
Just, I guess, that whole adage, just be kind to people. You've got no idea what everyone's going through. Everyone's got complex backgrounds, and you've got no idea what's going on in their life in that moment.
Mm.
Just be kind. Look after yourself. Don't be taken advantage of, but just be kind.
Be kind.
Yeah.
Be kind, Sonny. Something that if Holly listens to this podcast, you want to tell her now, away from the room.
I would just say I'm really proud of everything she's done. Like, she's an incredible mother. And she's done so much self-work and is forever doing that. And I think it's remarkable like how far she's come, whilst at the same time not developing any ego and being super humble and being loved by most people she meets.
Yeah, yeah. I had the same observation. She's a very humble person.
Mm.
She's got a lot of talent. Anyway, we can get into this. It's a whole another podcast, but she's a very humble person. That's, I agree with you. Something people misunderstand about you.
Oh, people always think my default face is arsehole.
Oh, really?
Like when it starts moving, it's fine. But my default face, I think, is quite like angry. So I think a lot of people have historically thought I was quite arrogant because when I teach, I'm quite strong.
Yeah.
And like, don't do that because of this. And I'm quite firm. I think it's important. There's a firm. Not every teacher needs to be firm, but my style of teaching firm. Do this because. Yeah. I'm teaching this sequence about this, so it makes no sense to do that. So I think there is an impression of kind of arrogance from me, and people either get me or don't. Like, the people that come to know me realise it's not arrogance particularly, it's just a bit firm and a bit sarcastic, and from Birmingham.
Brummy in you.
Yeah, but I think that sometimes is the case, yeah. I think maybe, you know, when people get to know me, that goes. But I think if you just see my social media, maybe actually my social media is getting better because it did used to be lots of me topless doing incredible poses.
Yeah.
And over the last few years, that's not been the case, or 5 years. But that plus, I think, my default face,
yeah,
and the fact that, you know, I used to be quite muscly and strong, and then maybe sort of vanity to that. But yeah.
Yeah, interesting. We're not who we think we are. We're not what others think we are. We are what we think other people think we are. Mm. We live in a perception of perception reality. Last one. If you create one law that everyone in the world has to follow, what would it be?
I would say males using urinals, using toilets, if they go in a cubicle to have it away, yeah, stand up,
yeah,
either shut the door and lock it or leave the door open. There's no halfway of kind of shutting the door but leaving it open so you walk in and just back into someone while they're weighing. That would be my rule.
Okay, that's a powerful one. We've not had that. I like that. Thank you so much, Adam.
No problem at all. It's a pleasure.
Real honor, real pleasure to speak with you, have this chat with you. Everyone that's listening, as always, feel permission to have a listen back to this podcast. It's not just a one-time entertainment business. We're trying to create transformative thought. We're trying to invite you to think about your own spirituality, your connection with yoga, your connection with holistic way of living. And I hope that that's coming through. So yeah, feel permission to have a listen again. Check out all the stuff that Adam's up to. He's an amazing soul.
Cool. And, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure and privilege. Thank you very much. See you guys on the next episode of For Soul's Sake. Namaste.